docket, case number 346135, Samuel Randall versus Michigan High School Athletic Association, which is the consolidated case with docket number 346476, same title. And have you decided on how you're going to split up your times?
We have not discussed it, Your Honor. I presume that as the appellant in the first case, I would go first, and I don't intend to take very long, but.
All right, well, why don't you go ahead, name on the record, please.
John Vanderplug, I'm here on behalf of the defendants, Anthony Palazzo and his employer, Metropolitan Health Corporation. Shall I proceed?
Yes, you should.
Okay, thank you. As you know, this is a bit of a tangled affair with these two appeals. It all stems from Mr. Randall's participation in a hockey game where he was knocked to the ice twice and hit his head. On the first occasion, and I'm not going to belabor the facts here as you well know them, Mr. Palazzo is an athletic trainer certified by the state of Michigan, employed by Metropolitan Health. He was there as an athletic trainer, and he went to the ice to see Mr. Randall, talk with him, and to determine whether he should be kept from play or returned to play. He made the evaluation, and he allowed him to return to play. He was knocked down again, and after that, he was taken from the game. He alleges here that he suffered concussive head injuries or an injury. And he has sued all of these folks who were in positions of responsibility, including Mr. Palazzo, for, in this case, ordinary negligence. And he cites a Michigan statute requiring people in charge to remove somebody with a suspected concussion. Again, he did not sue Mr. Palazzo or Metropolitan Health for medical malpractice in this action, and hence they filed a motion for summary disposition, contending that there was no viable claim for ordinary negligence. It had to be medical malpractice or not at all. The circuit judge first denied that motion. After more discovery, these defendants made that motion again. He denied it then. And so we applied for leave to appeal here, and this court granted that. So that's why we're here and we're the appellant. Our contention is that this is quite clearly a claim for medical malpractice. Mr. Palazzo is defined by Michigan statute as a licensed healthcare professional. He has training. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, can you answer to me this question? What kind of medical background does he have?
He has to go through.
I know he has the certification, but go ahead, I'm sorry.
He has to go through a rather strenuous and rigorous training program to be a licensed athletic trainer, and that's all set forth by statute and by regulation. And so he has gone through.
I've now unmuted it so that anybody could hear us.
Go ahead.
So that is all provided by regulation, and the statutory, the statutory scheme is set forth in MCL 333.17902 at SEC, and then there are regulations. So he went through it, he got the license, and he is licensed not as a medical doctor, but as a medical, an athletic trainer.
Is there any case law, or does the statute make clear that a certified athletic trainer can be held medically liable for malpractice, or liable for medical malpractice?
Well, I can't give you any off the top of my head. I know that they all acquire malpractice insurance.
That's not my question. I was on a case a few months ago, I forget, I think maybe April, where there was a question about whether an MRI technician could be sued for medical malpractice. And we went through the statutory analysis and said, you know, an MRI tech is not listed. And so the only way that they could be liable for medical malpractice is if they were working as an agent for an organization that could be sued for malpractice. Now, this athletic trainer, you know, I think it's questionable whether the, an athletic trainer, a certified athletic trainer would be, would meet that, that standard. But is the umbrella organization that you represent, they are subject to medical malpractice, I presume. Isn't that right?
Yes, Metropolitan Health Corporation, certainly, yeah.
And was he working as an agent of that entity when he was performing these services?
Well, I would say so. He was an employee of Metropolitan Health.
Okay.
And he was there in that capacity.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
And so that's the first question, I guess, is he liable, if at all, only for medical malpractice? And we can tell yes. Beyond that, and of course, then there's the fact that the plaintiff has never, until more recently and in a separate lawsuit, gone ahead with the medical malpractice statutory requirements to file a lawsuit.
So, Mr. Vanderplug, I've got another question.
Okay.
When I look at the statute, the standard of care for youth athletics, MCL 3339156, at least as I read that, I think you can make the argument that it sets forth two different negligence standards. The first provision, which, you know, applies to a coach or any other adult who suspects a concussion, they have to act immediately. They have to remove that athlete. That would seem to be an ordinary negligence standard. I don't see how that would be a medical malpractice standard, because it says any coach, and the vast majority of coaches are not going to have the kind of training that a medical professional would. But then you get to the second prong of that section, where the youth cannot return to physical activities unless they've been evaluated by an appropriate health professional and received written clearance. That I could see, you know, that might be a medical malpractice standard. So do you see how I've broken those down? And if I'm wrong, do you have any case law or statutory analysis
pointing
in the right direction?
Excuse me, I didn't mean to speak over.
No.
I agree with you and completely. I mean, it's a two, okay. You have all of these other folks who had responsibility and who were there, and they would have a responsibility under that statute if they suspected Mr. Randall of having suffered a concussion from taking him out of the game. But then there is the second part where he is to be evaluated, and he was then evaluated by Mr. Palazzo. That's his role in this, in pursuing the statute and its requirements.
Well, wait a minute. Why wouldn't Mr. Palazzo, as an adult volunteering or otherwise acting on behalf of an organization who was there, who may have witnessed this fall, why wouldn't Mr. Palazzo also be subject to that first prong's ordinary negligence standard, at least the way I read it?
Because he wasn't there in the same capacity as just any other responsible person. He was there as the licensed medical provider who was to make the evaluation. I'm not saying he's excused from any of this under the statute.
It doesn't, the first prong doesn't say a medical professional. It says a coach or any other adult. Your client was an adult there.
So
was he employed by, volunteering, or otherwise acting on behalf of an organization entity during an athletic event?
Well, yes, but okay, let me try to break this down a little bit. I think I agree with you, except for the fact that once if he suspected, as maybe the others were required to look at it and suspect that Mr. Palazzo had suffered a concussion, he needed-
Mr. Randall.
As an adult.
Graham.
Pardon?
Randall Graham, not the,
yeah.
Go ahead.
He would have then needed to take him out of the game until he evaluated him as the medical professional and determined that he could return or not return. And he determined, having talked with him and looked at him and done the evaluation, that he could return. So it doesn't make any sense to hold him liable for the suspicion like the others might have had when he's there in a different role and he fulfills that role as a medical provider, the second part of the statute. Well, yeah, I know it is confusing, Your Honor, but.
I mean, I, you know, just again, this is an interesting case. Procedurally, it's kind of got a lot of twists and turns. But again, I'm just going to lay out the way I provisionally see it for your client. Your client is arguably subject to two standards. The first standard would be the one that everybody else, all the other coaches and adults, you know, the referees, whatever, would be subject to, which is you need to take the youth athlete out if there's a suspicion of a concussion. That would be an ordinary negligence standard as I read the statute. Then your client would also be subject to a different standard later on when there's a fuller evaluation to determine whether that youth athlete has recovered from a concussion. That I would read as a medical malpractice standard. Now, why am I wrong with regard to that first?
Well, I'm thinking maybe you're suggesting that as just like the other adults there, he had an obligation to take him out of the game.
Right. Why is that wrong?
Because in his role as medical professional to evaluate him, he had to determine whether there was a suspicion, not just a suspicion, but whether he might have suffered or had suffered a concussion. I mean,
okay.
I don't know if that helps or not, but I can't see how this could work as they've drafted it. If he could be held liable with the others for having the suspicion, but having made the evaluation concluding that he didn't suffer a concussion.
Okay.
All right.
I think you really have two categories of defendants here. And he is first and foremost the medical professional there to make the evaluation of whether the suspicion has come to a fruition that there is a concussion.
All right, thank you. Do you have any further questions, judges?
No.
All right, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Graham?
Thank you, Your Honor. Can everybody hear me well enough?
Yes, I can.
Okay. This case is about failing to apply.
You know, can you hang on just a second? I think that Mr. Van Dusen is having some connection problems.
Okay.
Mr. Van Dusen, why don't you try to hit the unmute button on your computer and see if that works?
Judge Kelly, can you hear us?
Yes, we can. Yeah. All right, great. Okay, Mr. Graham, if you want to put your appearance on the record again.
Thank you. Raul Graham for Plaintiff Sam Randall. Did that come through okay?
That yes. Came through. And you're going to want to address both cases in your oral argument.
I see. Okay. I can do both at the same time.
Yeah, you'll have to.
The athletic trainer's role, I'm going to disagree here with Mr. Van Dusen. The athletic trainer's role is not to see if a suspected concussion has come to fruition, because the statute that governs athletic trainers says that athletic trainers are not to practice medicine, they're not to diagnose, and they're not to treat. And the agreement between Grand Rapids Christian Schools and the athletic trainer, which puts Mr. Palazzo in the position of being the athletic trainer for the contest, echoes that language and specifically says he does not diagnose, he does not treat, he does not practice medicine. So Mr. Palazzo's role in the game is the same and similar to the other coaches.
And I mean, why is he there then?
He's there to do what he was doing when Sam got hit and knocked out. He's there to look at other players' injuries and treat those injuries. Like, I think there was testimony that he was attending to a player's knee who got his knee hurt. So he does physical therapy. He evaluates medical injuries to see if the player has to go to the doctor. When a player is removed from the game and taken off the ice. But in this case is about failing to apply and to follow the player safety rule that says you're supposed to pull the goalie from the ice if a concussion is suspected. That Mr. Palazzo failed to take the steps required of him by the MHSA protocol and the statute is failing to take response to a known risk, and that sounds an ordinary negligence. So the court has to consider the claim as a whole rather than piecemeal. And the gravamen of the complaint that we filed is that the coaches, officials, and athletic trainer failed to take action to immediately remove Sam from the ice after both hits, the first hit and the second hit. And the evidence is Sam never left the ice after the first hit to be evaluated to see if he had sustained a concussion. So failure to follow the statute and the MHSA protocol sounds in ordinary negligence, because a jury can consider the issue of very simply, without any expert testimony regarding what athletic trainers do and what their training is, just very simply, they can watch the video, hear the testimony, and then take the rule with them into the jury room and decide whether or not that rule was followed.
Well, that raises an interesting issue of what record are we actually looking at? Because I'm concerned that there have been efforts to supplement the record on appeal when we're supposed to be looking at what the trial judge looked at when making the summary disposition rulings. And so Randall's deposition testimony was before the trial judge. The video of the two hits was before the trial judge. And then I think the consent form was before the trial judge. Beyond that, what else specifically is appropriately in the record and not simply being supplemented on appeal?
That is essentially the record, especially as it pertains to the coaches and officials and what we knew at the time, because our argument is that had discovery been allowed to continue, then the two witnesses that Sam Randall named in the first part of his deposition, which in this case was the only exhibit. There were two volumes of depositions. There was the volume one of Sam Randall that took place in July, and then there was the volume two of Sam Randall that took place after the appeals were filed. In the first deposition, he named two witnesses, John Ellis and Mark Stevenson, who were watching the game and who said that he said they told him that he was knocked out and laying on the ice for 4 minutes. That's where the 4 minutes came from. But at any rate, the evidence was from Sam's deposition that I got hit, I was knocked out. When I came to, I was flat on the ice. So that's where the information in our briefs came from, that regardless of whether it was 4 minutes, because the trial court judge said there's no evidence to establish that Randall was laying on the ice for 4 minutes, which was not the issue. The issue is he was laying on the ice for some period of time after everyone saw him get knocked in the head. And the testimony from the first part of his deposition was, I got knocked out, I'm laying flat cold on the ice. And I got two witnesses in the stands that saw that. So That's the testimony. Then we have the video of the hits, for which the trial court judge said there's that plaintiff has failed to provide documentary evidence that the coaches or the officials saw him sustain a concussion. If you look at the video as it pans across on the play where Sam gets hit at the net, which is the first hit, you can see the coaches standing up and looking at the play from their benches. The camera actually shows the coaches watching the game. So given all inferences in favor of the plaintiff, there's evidence that we submitted that the coaches and the presumably the officials, because they were officiating the game and skating around, but the coaches standing there watching the play immediately before the hit would establish that they did see him get hit in the head and go down on the ice. And then, of course, later on, you talked about evidence supplementing the appeal. Later on, we did do the coach Fedorinchik's deposition, and he did say, yes, I saw the play. Yes, I saw him get hit in the head. So
that's not before us on appeal, correct?
Right. Okay. And our argument on the duty and theory of liability to bring the coaches and officials back in is that that liability is the same as for the athletic trainer, because there's a statute and there's a player safety rule. So the issue with the coaches and officials is not whether they should have overruled the athletic trainer's decision. It's whether they had a duty to act independently, to exercise their common sense. And both the statute and the protocol say in the plain language that they do, because being
Why wouldn't it be sufficient for the coach to rely on the athletic trainer who actually went out and looked at the youth? You know, if the athletic trainer came off the ice and said, he looks great, you know, nothing's going on with his eyes, he can count from 1 to 10, 10 to 9, whatever. Why wouldn't that be enough to absolve the coach of liability under that statute?
Because being knocked out in full view of everyone in attendance is a sign and symptom of a concussion, which doesn't require a coach or official to consult with anyone prior to discharging their duty under the statute protocol to pull him from the ice and remove him from the game. The statute says a coach or other adult shall immediately remove a youth suspected of sustaining a concussion. If everyone sees him there go down, and you know, then the issue is, how can everyone watching the game know, after seeing Sam get hit in the head and go down on the ice and witness him being knocked out cold, then how does the athletic trainer or the coaches see something different and don't pull him from the game? Because we are alleging in the complaint, not that Mr. Palazzo did an evaluation. That's defendant's claim. They submitted to support their argument for this being a medical malpractice case that there was some sort of evaluation after the first hit. That's not the evidence. The evidence from the SCAT form, the concussion form, and the Metro Health form that they produced as an exhibit, as they say, a reason to claim that it sounds in med mal, that was filled out after the second hit, after the fact, and well after the first hit. So then, of course, defendant Palazzo goes back to the coaches and falsely reports that Sam had no symptoms. There's no evidence of evaluation. There's no evidence of him being removed from the ice. There's just a claim that there was actually an evaluation after the first hit, but that claim comes up in something that was retroactively documented after the first hit to cover up the failure to act. Our complaint is he didn't do what he was supposed to do and then tried to cover it up. Not that there was actually an evaluation. That's defendant's claim. All we know for sure from the evidence is that Mr. Palazzo went out to the ice, and from Sam's depth, we hear that he said, are you good to play? And Sam says, I'm good to go. And then he goes back to the coaches and play resumes. So our theory of the case is not that an evaluation was done and done incorrectly. It was that there's an issue of material fact as to whether an evaluation was done or whether this was just a retroactive documentation of something that never happened. And that's a jury issue. A jury question.
Okay.
So at any rate, defendant Palazzo's only job was to observe whether a concussion can be suspected. And if so, you pull him from participation, you take him to the locker room, you evaluate him. He can't treat, he can't diagnose. So there was no need to assess. No medical judgment was required and no expert testimony necessary to get any further down the line to know that a concussion should be suspected. It's common sense. If a kid gets hit in the head, gets knocked out and is lying for some period of time motionless on the ice, then I think it's normal for anyone to suspect a concussion. I don't think we need an athletic trainer to give a medical opinion, which he's not even allowed to do under the athletic trainer statute, but to opine as to whether or not there's a suspected concussion. So what we're arguing is the scope of the duty question. We're saying the negligence we're claiming is limited to failure to follow the concussion statute and the protocol. The question for the jury is, did they follow the rules? I mean, if this was my child or your child, one would expect that the statute exists for him to be pulled from the game, taken off the ice, sent to the locker room, and evaluated by a medical professional, not an athletic trainer, if a concussion is suspected. That's why the standard is a suspected concussion and not a concussion. Sam was a minor at the time. This was a high school game, and the game played under MHSAA rules with those officials and those responsible adults holds itself out as a safe environment in which children are supposed to be able to play hockey. So there's no medical question here that we're claiming that goes beyond common understanding. And to that point, there's no affidavit of merit requirement under MCL 600-291 applicable to this claim, because the expert witness statute for medical malpractice covers situations in which expert testimony needs to be given against a specialist for standard of care. But since the negligence here that we alleged in the complaint does not involve the specialty of the athletic trainer, even if this court could somehow conclude that some of the claims that plaintiff might have involving an evaluation, if a jury says the evaluation did take place after the first hit, constituted medical malpractice, the court still must conclude that the affidavit of merit requirement is inapplicable to the negligence that was pleaded. It was the athletic trainer's failure to act, knowing the facts, knowing the dangers, knowing the rules of the game, not tied to any professional relationship, that requires testimony as to whether he treated or not, which dovetails nicely into the next issue, which is that this case doesn't raise any questions of medical judgment. Not only I'll short form my argument, make it a little easier for the court, but the elements of medical malpractice simply aren't met.
Okay. Anything further?
Yeah. Yes. Just briefly on interpretation of the statute, and then one or two more things on the coaches, if I have time. I think defendants are trying to relitigate Bryant. The court can't ignore the fact that to come within the defendant's proposed definition of medical malpractice, as derived from section 5838A1, defendant must not only have been engaged in providing medical care to Sam, which he wasn't and he can't, but they must also have been engaged in providing medical treatment to him, which an athletic trainer can't do because the athletic trainer statute and the agreement between defendant Palazzo and the school forbids it. So whether he failed to perform an evaluation after the first hit on the ice or a proper evaluation on the first hit is completely erroneous. It's not a treatment or care issue. The athletic trainer statute directly refutes defendant's argument because he can't diagnose and he can't treat.
Judges, do you have any further questions for Mr. Graham?
No questions. No. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'd like the record to reflect that Mr. Van Dusen is now on the phone. Mr. Van Dusen, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Your Honor. Thank you. And I apologize for the technical difficulties we've had here.
Well, that's okay. Everybody's new to this, you know. Judge Schwartz, right. Schwartzel and Judge Hood are both veterans of this. This is my first time, too. So go ahead, and I'll start the clock.
And I do want to say at the outset, really as an apology, that if there were, I was not able to get online and hear the argument until counsel for plaintiff's argument began. So to the extent that I maybe am not addressing something that occurred during co-defendant's argument, I apologize for that. I did not hear it.
Okay.
So with that out of the way, Thomas Van Dusen here for the defendants. St. Francis High School, Grand Traverse Area Catholic Schools, Bay Reps Hockey Associations, which was really a consolidation of five area high schools, and Ryan Federnchik, the coach. The claim against these defendants, the St. Francis High School defendants, is based on an allegation that the coach was negligent, because he did not remove plaintiff Samuel Randall from the hockey game after he was involved in a collision. The second collision, by the way, is academic, because the testimony of Samuel was that he immediately left the ice himself after that second collision. So the claim is that the coach was negligent for not removing Sam from the ice after that first collision. And then the claim against the other defendants, the school, the hockey association, is based on a doctrine of respondeat superior. So we submit that the test for adjudicating the claim against the coach involves a question of whether he engaged in negligence. And I think that the test for that, as it applies to the facts in this case, is very simple, and that there are no disputed issues of material fact as it relates to that claim. Judge Schwartzel, if I could please address one question that you asked. When you asked about the evidence that was, if you will, on the record when the court made its decision in October 2018, one other important piece of evidence is the medical evaluation form that the trainer filled out. That's Exhibit 3 to defendant's appeal, and that was an evaluation form that Anthony Palazzo filled out between the second and third period. So to the extent plaintiff's trying to suggest that there was a long time delay in preparing this report, it was prepared within minutes of the collision.
But I guess my question is, was that a piece of evidence before the trial judge when the trial judge ruled on the summary disposition motion?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. That was one of the exhibits to the summary disposition briefing record.
Okay.
So I think if I could please now really focusing on plaintiff's claim, plaintiffs rely on MCL 333.9156, which is the concussion statute. And they go so far as to argue in their appeal brief and did it again today that under the statute, lay personnel such as Coach Federnchik have an independent duty to assess the condition of the plaintiff. And the fact is, if you look at the language of the statute, and this is subparagraph 3 of that statute, it says, and I quote, a coach or other adult employed by, volunteering for, or otherwise acting on behalf of an organizing entity during an athletic event. That or other adult, that's exactly what Palazzo was. There's no question about that Palazzo was functioning as the trainer for both teams. And I will get to that more in a minute, but there's no possible interpretation of the statute that would justify a conclusion that the coach had an independent duty if a trainer was present, because the statute, as I just said.
But I guess I'm not reading the statute the same way you are, because I don't see something where it says a coach or if a certified trainer is available, the certified trainer must blah, blah, blah. I mean, it doesn't seem to be, the certified trainer doesn't legally under the statute seem to absolve other adults from their own independent duty under the statute. So how am I misreading the statute?
Well, I think that Palazzo is a quote, other adult, otherwise acting on behalf of an organizing entity. So in this case, Palazzo's role was he was the trainer for Grand Rapids Christian High School, but he was also functioning for the purposes of this event as the trainer for the St. Francis High School hockey team as well. And if I could, I don't want to jump ahead too much, Judge, but that's exactly what plaintiff alleges in its complaint.
I guess before we get to that, I agree with you that Palazzo would fall under an other adult. But I mean, your client, the individual, was a coach employed by, volunteering yes. for, or otherwise acting on behalf.
Yes.
Okay. So
we believe that Palazzo can and should be interpreted as an other adult who was functioning for the organizing entity during that event.
Okay.
And by the way, Judge, plaintiff makes that allegation in its amended complaint. In fact, if I could, I'll just jump ahead to that right now. In plaintiff's amended complaint, which is second amended complaint, by the way, which is exhibit one to defendant's appeal brief, paragraph 30, they allege defendant Palazzo retained by defendant Grand Rapids Christian School to act in a role of athletic trainer and thereby treat and evaluate medical conditions developed during the above mentioned contest, including but not limited to concussions. Then in paragraph 31, it says, per standard operating procedure of the league and by agreement of the two involved teams, defendant Palazzo was to act as the athletic trainer for both teams involved in the contest. And then it goes on to allege in paragraph 34, after the first collision, defendant Palazzo entered the ice surface to ascertain plaintiff's condition. And then at paragraph 35, defendant Palazzo allowed plaintiff to continue participating in the contest. So I think plaintiff's own allegations recognize the role that Palazzo had. And then the other part of this statute is that plaintiff, I think, just really overlooks is the statute, the concussion statute, and rightly so, does not require that every athlete who was involved in a collision must be removed from the game. The obligation for removal is instead, and again, this is right from the statute quoting, only if the athlete who's been involved in a collision is suspected, quote, suspected of having sustained a concussion. And the Michigan High School Athletic Standard, which plaintiff also relies upon, says the exact same thing.
That's an interesting question. So if Mr. Randall was deposed and said, I don't remember how long I was down, I just remember, you know, being down on the ice and waking up. And if in his complaint, he alleges 4 minutes, and that's all that's in the record for purposes of this summary disposition review, I mean, laying on the ice for 4 minutes, you know, relatively still, I don't see how that's not at least a jury question on whether that is a, whether a reasonable person would have known to suspect a sustained concussion.
Well, that could be the case, Your Honor, but for the fact that when Palazzo went out there, and this is reflected in Exhibit 3 to defendant's appeal brief, as well as in his testimony that occurred months after the order was entered, he said that he went through a entire list of checkpoints with Samuel Randall. And part of the reason for doing that was to ask if Sam was able to listen to him, answer the questions correctly, make contact, et cetera. And if you look at that Exhibit 3, he says that Samuel denied, quote, any dizziness, feeling in a fog, not feeling right, no troubles with light sensitivity, and asked if he thinks he could continue, and he said he could. That was the assessment that the trainer Palazzo made based on his own observations and what Samuel told him. So
that exhibit was not before the trial judge when the trial judge ruled on these summary disposition motions, correct?
So Your Honor, I apologize. The Palazzo deposition was not before the court when the court ruled on the motion, but exhibit 3 to defendant's appeal brief was part of the summary disposition briefing record. That's the document entitled Sports Medicine Athletic Injury Evaluation, which Mr. Palazzo filled out during the game.
Okay.
Okay.
You're getting really short on time here, Mr. Van Duzen. You might want to summarize your argument.
Okay, thank you very much, Judge. I think the final point to make here is that if you took plaintiff's theory of liability to what would be illogical, but I think by any account, totally absurd conclusion, under plaintiff's theory, Ryan, the coach for Dorachuk, was supposed to second guess the assessment of a trainer that plaintiff was not suspected of having sustained a concussion, thereby allowing Mr. Randall to remain in the game. That's plaintiff's entire case against the coach. The corollary to that, we believe, would be that if in contrast, Mr. Palazzo had determined that plaintiff was suspected of having sustained a concussion, thereby requiring under the statute that he be removed from the game. If according to plaintiff, the coach has an obligation to second guess the trainer, that would mean that the coach could have overruled that determination by a healthcare professional and allow plaintiff to continue. I think that's something that really points out the flaws in plaintiff's reasoning. Sure, there are a lot of sport events where a trainer may not be present, and in those cases, a coach could not stand on the bench and watch a plaintiff lay on the ice unattended to with no one coming to him whatsoever. That wasn't the case here. And plaintiff's own complaint acknowledges it. As soon as the collision occurred, the trainer went out there, he examined plaintiff, and then he told the coaches that he could continue. So I know I'm done.
You are, yeah.
I apologize. We respectfully request the court to affirm the summary disposition order as to these defendants.
Thank you, Mr. Van Duzen. Okay, Mr. Vanderpool, you've got 2 minutes if you want to respond to the plaintiff.
I'll take perhaps one.
Okay.
I just want to, I guess, summarize our position very briefly is that Mr. Palazzo attended that game in his role as a certified, licensed athletic trainer. He was there for that purpose and that purpose alone. That is defined as a licensed medical care provider. His, looking at the statute, the concussion statute, it was his job to go out there and determine whether Mr. Palazzo was suspected of having a concussion. And he did that according to his duty as a medical provider.
Thank you. Mr. Grant, do you have anything to sum up?
I do. I have 4 quick points. The first one being with regard to Exhibit 3, the Metro Health Sports Medicine form, it clearly states with regard to Sam, he said he had a headache after hitting the ice, and then under initial treatment, it says removed from the game, which we know not to be true, because if I can respond to Mr. Van Duzen, the testimony of the second hit is not academic. The coach didn't remove Sam after the first hit. Sam said he removed himself after the second hit, after not being able to see. He tried to get the coach's attention, couldn't get their attention. Sam removed himself. So even if the court could hold that there might be a medical malpractice component to the latter actions after the first hit of the athletic trainer, Sam got hit twice. Neither time was he pulled from the game. And there's no dispute that he mentioned that he hit his head. So it's ordinary negligence, because at that point, the athletic trainer, after the first hit, was on notice. He knew Sam got hit in the head, knew he went down on the ice, knew he experienced a headache or got hit in the head, knew he wanted out, and did nothing. So if the first hit has any sort of evaluation component to it, the second one doesn't. And nothing in the statute or the protocol says that Coach Fedorenchik can use the mere presence of athletic trainer Palazzo on the ice as a shield to liability, you know, and as a shield to suspecting a concussion, when the evidence is, we see from the video, he gets hit in the head, he goes down. Sam says, I was down, I was knocked out. So you can't say, hey, I relied on the fact that the athletic trainer told me he experienced no symptoms, when the reason for the statute and the protocol are for adults supervising minors in a hockey game to make that game safe, to do what they're supposed to do when exactly this kind of thing happens. When the facts and the circumstances of an actual concussion are visible to everybody present, all right, then I think there's an ordinary duty on everybody.
Okay. Thank you. You know, Mr. Murray, I neglected to have you put your appearance on the record. I know you're not endorsed, but if you'd like to go ahead and do that now.
Sure. My name is Thomas Murray, Jr., and I represent the Grand Rapids Schools.
Thank you very much.
That Grand case will be. It's the Grand Rapids Christian Schools. I'm sorry.
All right. The case will be submitted. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.